This is Audible.
Recorded books and one-click digital present The Life She Wants by Robin Carr. Narrated by Therese Plummer. Prologue. When the truth became brutally evident, she wondered how it had escaped her for so long. Emma Shea Compton knew that her marriage to Richard looked like a fairy tale to many, and though she'd loved Richard, she'd always felt something was lacking. She couldn't put her finger on it. It was so vague. Richard was good to her, generous, though he was an extremely busy man, and soon after their wedding, he became remote, distant. She told herself mega-rich brokers don't sit around the house coddling their young wives. They work 16-hour days. They're never far from their phones. They seem to command multitudes. And if a person, even his wife, wanted to get on his calendar, she had to plan ahead. So whenever she felt that something was wrong with her marriage, she'd blame herself. When Richard's lawyers began to meet with him to discuss problems with the SEC, she barely noticed. When she asked him about media reports that his company was being investigated for securities fraud, he calmly said, "Slow news day." Then he lectured her. "Pay attention to the financial pages. It happens every day. Several multi-billion dollar banking and investment corporations are currently being investigated. The SEC has to justify its existence somehow. I resent the time suck, but it won't last long." She didn't worry about it, though she did pay attention as he suggested. Of course, he was right. There were many investigations. Steep fines, reorganizations, buyouts, companies shutting down. The banking and investment world was under very close scrutiny. Then he said they had to appear in court, he and his legal team. He wanted her by his side and asked if she could get it on her schedule, and she laughed. "I'm not the one with the full schedule, Richard." He smiled his perfect, confident, calm smile. He touched her cheek. "You won't have to do or say anything." The morning they were to appear in court, he'd noticed the suit she laid over the chair and said, "Perfect." Then he went into his bathroom. Sitting at her dressing table, she was smoothing lotion on her legs. She heard the water running in his sink. And then she heard, "Son of a bitch." He'd cut himself shaving and swore. Not unusual for him. But she met her own eyes in the mirror. Suddenly, she knew. She'd been living a lie, and everything said about him was true. Her husband was a cold, calculating liar and thief. And she couldn't pretend anymore. Chapter 1. It's the little things that will break you. Emma Shea had been thinking about that a lot lately. She stood strong while everything was taken from her, while she was virtually imprisoned at a little motel near the Jersey Shore, while her husband was buried, while the media spun a sordid tale of deceit and thievery that implied she'd been aware, if not complicit, in her late husband's crimes. Stood strong. But when the heel broke on her best slingback pumps and she tumbled down the courthouse steps, she collapsed in tears. The photo was printed everywhere, even People magazine. When she was asked to please stop coming to her yoga studio, she thought she would die of shame and cried herself to sleep. No one had ever explained to her that the last straw weighed almost nothing. Everything in her Manhattan apartment and vacation home had been auctioned off. She packed up some practical items to take with her and donated some of her casual clothing to women's shelters. Of course, anything of value, the art, crystal, china, silver, and jewelry had been seized quickly, even items she could prove had nothing to do with Richard's business, including wedding gifts from friends. They took her designer clothing. Her Vera Wang wedding gown was gone. She was allowed to keep a couple sets of good sheets, towels, one set of kitchenware, some glasses, a few placemats, napkins, and so on. She had a box of photos, most from before Richard. She stuffed it all in her Prius. The Jag was gone, of course. She'd been offered a financial settlement, since they couldn't establish that she had anything to do with Richard's Ponzi scheme. Couldn't prove it, since she was innocent. She hadn't testified against him, not out of loyalty or because it was her legal prerogative, but rather because she had nothing to say, nothing upon which to leverage some kind of deal. She hadn't been in court every day out of support for Richard, but because it was the best way for her to learn about the crimes he was accused of. She'd come into the marriage with $9,000 in savings. She left as a widow, keeping $9,000 in a checking account. It would be her emergency fund. She started a trip across the country, leaving New York behind and heading for Sonoma County, where she grew up. She'd given it all a great deal of thought. She'd been thinking about it for months before Richard's death. She could have kept the entire settlement and retired to the Caribbean, or maybe Europe. She'd been fond of Switzerland. She could change her name, color her hair, lie about her past. But eventually people would figure her out. And then what? Run again? Instead, she surrendered the settlement, gave up everything she could have kept. She didn't want Richard's ill-gotten gains. Even though she hadn't swindled anyone, she couldn't, in good conscience, touch any of it. There were people she knew back in the Santa Rosa area, a few she'd stayed in touch with. The area was familiar to her. There wasn't much family anymore. Her stepmother, Rosemary, had moved to Palm Springs with her third husband. As far as she knew, Emma's stepsister Anna and half-sister Lauren still lived in the house they'd all grown up in. They'd all washed their hands of Emma when Richard was indicted. In fact, the last time she'd talked to her stepmother was right before Richard's death, when all the walls were tumbling down. Emma was literally in hiding from the angry victims of Richard's fraud, victims who believed Emma had gotten away with some of their money. Rosemary had said, "Well, your greed has certainly cost you this time." "Rosemary, I didn't do anything," Emma reminded her. And then Rosemary said what everyone thought. "So you say." Well, Rosemary had always thought the worst of her, but Emma hoped the people she knew in Sonoma County wouldn't. She'd grown up there, gone to Catholic school and public high school there. And she thought it was extremely unlikely any clients, now victims, of Richard's New York-based investment company hailed from the little towns in Sonoma County. Her closest friend, possibly her only friend at this point, Lyle Dressler, found her a little furnished bungalow in Sebastopol. Lyle and his partner lived in the town, so she had some moral support there. Emma was 34 and had married Richard Compton 9 years ago. He was a sharp, handsome, successful 45 when they married. At 25, she'd been completely under his spell. He might have been 20 years older than her, but 45 was hardly considered old. He was fit, handsome, brilliant, rich, and powerful. In fact, he was considered one of the most desired bachelors in New York City. Rosemary and Emma's sisters had certainly liked him then. They were eager to travel to New York to attend any social event Richard would grudgingly include them in. But they hadn't offered 1 ounce of support to Emma during the takedown. The few years of marriage before the investigation and indictment hadn't been heaven on earth, but they weren't bad. Her complaints seemed to be standard among people she knew. He was busy, preoccupied. They didn't spend enough time together, even when they were traveling. The first friends she'd made through work in New York had gradually drifted away once she settled into her multi-million-dollar marriage. She'd never quite fit in with the elite crowd, so she'd been a little lonely. It seemed like she was always around people, doing her part with committee work, exercising, decorating, entertaining, feeling that she must be indispensable to Richard. However, he was all she really had, It was a dark and terrible day when she realized he was a complete stranger. Before her fifth anniversary, the investigation had begun. Before the seventh, indictments had been handed down and assets frozen. She spent her eighth anniversary in court. Richard's defense attorneys had managed many a delay, but eventually there was a trial, a circus of a trial, and she appeared to be the trusting good wife, head held high. Richard's mother and sister hadn't come to the trial and refused interviews. She'd always assumed they didn't think she was good enough for Richard. But after the trial, she changed her opinion. They must have known all about him. He was dark and empty inside. He never talked to her about it, at least not until the ugly, bitter end. When she asked about the investigation, he just said they were out to get him. That business was tough, but he was tougher, that they'd never prove anything. At the end, there had been a few brief, nasty, but revealing discourses. How could you? How could I not? How could you justify the greed? My greed? How about their greed? Do they have to justify it? They wanted me to do anything to make the money. They wanted me to spin straw into gold even if I had to lie, cheat, and steal. Each one of them just wanted their payday before it all broke. The feds proved everything with ease. Employees cut deals and testified against him. Truckloads of documentation proved securities fraud, theft, mail fraud, wire fraud, money laundering. The list was long. When the end was near, when he'd attempted a getaway and been unceremoniously returned by U.S. Marshals, when his offshore accounts had been located and identified, when he faced a long jail sentence with no nest egg left hidden away, Richard shot himself. Of course, no one believed Emma had no idea. Apparently, people thought he came home from the office and bared his soul over a drink. He had not. The Richard she knew was obviously a con man, a chameleon. He could be so charming, so devoted, but he always had a plan and always wanted something more. Why wouldn't I marry you? You were an outstanding investment, perfect for the role. It's a well-known fact. People trust married men more than single men. He was a narcissist, a manipulator, a liar and cheat. He was so damn good at it. A person could feel almost honored to be manipulated and lied to by him. He had the looks of Richard Gere, the brilliance of Steve Jobs, the ethics of Bernie Madoff. Thank God he wasn't as successful as Bernie. Richard had only managed to steal about $100 million. What did she know? She knew he was private. He didn't talk about work, which she thought was normal behavior for a powerful man. He was an amazing communicator socially and in business. But once he stopped courting her, he stopped telling her stories about his family, his youth, college, about his early years on Wall Street. She knew he didn't have many old friends, just a lot of business contacts. She never met college pals or colleagues from his early professional days. He did routinely ask her about her day, however. He'd ask her about her schedule, her projects, what she did, who she talked to, what was happening in her world. When he was home, that is. He was often working late or traveling. The thing that set Richard apart from other mediocre con men, he knew how to listen. People, herself included, thought they'd learned something about him when he hadn't said a word about himself. But he listened to them, raptly. They were thrilled by this attention. 1 9-year marriage, a few years of which had been weirdly adequate, 5 years of which had been a nightmare. Now she wondered when the nightmare would end. Emma drove directly to Lyle's Flower Shop, Hello Gorgeous, named for Barbara Streisand, of course. Lyle had been wonderful to her through this whole ordeal. He hadn't been able to be in New York with her very often. Not only was it a great costly distance, but there was also the small complication that his partner, Ethan, had never been particularly fond of Emma, though he didn't really know her. Lyle had made a couple of trips, however, and called almost daily during the rough patches. She understood about Ethan, but Lyle and Emma had been friends long before Ethan came into his life. For reasons unknown, Ethan had never warmed to her. Emma suspected good old-fashioned jealousy, as if Emma might bring out Lyle's straight side or something. So Emma and Ethan had always had a rather cool regard for each other. But since Richard's debacle, Ethan's regard had gone from cool to frigid. But, and this was an important but, if Ethan went on about his dislike and disapproval of Emma too much, he was going to lose Lyle. And he might be bitchy, but he wasn't stupid. Emma stood outside the shop and took a deep breath before walking through the door. And, of course, who should be behind the counter but Ethan? "Well, Emma, I see you made it," he said as though it took effort to be kind. "Yes, thank you," she answered carefully. "Rough journey?" Ethan surprised her by asking. "In every way," she said.
"Well, there you are," Lyle said as he came from the back and rushed over to embrace her. "Would you like a cup of coffee or something before we head over to Penny's house?"
She shook her head.
"I parked down the block in the only available space. I'd like to get going. I have a lot to do."
"Sure," he said. He turned to Ethan. "I'm going to give Emma a hand, visit with Penny a little. I'll probably grab something to eat with them. I won't be late."
Ethan lifted his chin and sniffed, but his reply was perfectly appropriate.
"I think I'll drop in on Nora and Ed. Sounds like a good night to get a little uncle time."
"Excellent. Give them my love."
Then, hand on her elbow, Lyle escorted her out of the shop.
"I'm parked right here. I'll drive you down to your car," he said.
"Oh, please, no," she said, laughing. "My butt hurts so bad, I hate to even get back in the car. I'm going to walk. It's only a block. And I have a cooler with some drinks for us. Listen, I don't want to..." She tilted her head toward the store. "I don't want to cause any friction. If you'll just get me to the house and introduce me to your friend, I can manage from there."
"No worries, Emma. I explained to Ethan days ago that I was going to lend a hand when you got here."
He chuckled.
He was very adult about it.
"It's time for him to pay his sister a visit anyway. They live a mile away, and Ethan doesn't visit as often as he should. I think I visit more than he does. We have a gorgeous niece. He can go over there and complain about me and my stubborn ways. Besides, I want to make sure you're all right."
She smiled at him with gratitude.
"I might never be all right again," she said. "All I want right now is a little quiet and anonymity."
"Have you heard from Rosemary?"
he asked.
"I did her the courtesy of emailing her that I'd be moving to a small bungalow in Sebastopol and told her I could be reached through you. I don't even trust her enough to give her my new cell number. I bet she'd sell it to the press."
"I take it you haven't heard from her?"
He shook his head, and this came as no surprise. Rosemary had been in touch when she thought Richard was rich and powerful. After his fall from grace, she behaved as if she didn't know him.
"We haven't made amends. She wasn't exactly supportive."
"Your sister should be helping you now," he said.
They had never done anything to help her.
"We've never been that kind of family," she said.
Indeed, they weren't family at all.
"I can relate,"
Lyle said. Emma knew Lyle had always had a hard time with his father, but at least his mother adored him. She gave his upper arm a squeeze.
"Well, you've saved my life here. I'd be lost without this little place you found."
"It found me. Penny is elderly, but don't use that word around her. She's what we'd call spry. Almost 80 and still walking 3 miles a day, gardening and playing the occasional game of tennis. But the problem with living forever, The money thins out eventually.
And she knows everything? Emma asked.
He nodded. As you wished. She said, we've all hooked up with the wrong person here and there. Poor girl. This little bungalow is a sort of guest house, a casita. Though her house, the main house, isn't that much bigger. Prepare yourself. It's all quite small. She doesn't need a keeper. No care involved. But a little bit of rent will probably help you both.
He shook his head.
I don't know that you've ever lived in anything this simple, Em. It's old, musty, small, and tacky.
You have no idea how much I'm looking forward to it. The guest house was actually a remodeled freestanding garage with a wall and large picture window where the doors once were. The window looked out onto a pleasant tree-lined street. It was a tiny two-room bungalow with a small bathroom and galley kitchen. A patio separated the guest house from Penelope Pennington's two-bedroom house.
And of course you're welcome to use the patio at any time, Penny assured her. And if you ever have any serious cooking to do, feel free to borrow my kitchen.
It was an attractive little arrangement. Penny had the driveway removed years before, and now there was a carport and storage unit. In front of both little houses and on either side of the driveway and carport were two small patches of grass, shrubs, trees, and flowers. From the patio, one could reach Emma's little abode on the right, or Penny's on the left. A tall white fence with a gate bordered the property. It took less than half an hour to unload Emma's small car. There wasn't much furniture in the bungalow. A bed and bureau, a small table and two chairs, a couple of lamps, a small sofa and two armchairs. She had her own bedding and kitchenware. She found the guest house quaint and cozy. Her boxes and suitcases had yet to be unpacked, but she didn't care. Lyle went off to a nearby market to get dinner, bringing Penny and Emma a huge Greek salad, some hummus, flatbread, and a bottle of wine. They had their dinner at Penny's, sitting around her little dining table, and Emma loved her at once. Then, at last, it was just Emma and Lyle, sitting in her cozy living room with a final glass of wine. She sat in a musty old overstuffed chair upholstered with a floral pattern, her feet up on an ottoman that didn't quite match. Lyle relaxed on the sofa, his feet up on the coffee table.
"This place really needs a fluffin' buff," he said.
"I love it," she said. "I think this will be my reading chair."
"How can you read with the flowers and that gaudy print screaming at you?"
She laughed at him.
"Have you given any thought to what kind of job you're going to get?"
he asked.
"Well," she said, taking a thoughtful sip,
"I was considering being a life coach. What do you think?"
"You can certainly provide plenty of experience with what not to do," he said.
"I can honestly say I haven't felt this relaxed in years," she said. Lyle was quiet for a moment.
"Emmy, I don't know what it's going to be like for you around here. It's a quiet town, but not without its resident gossips and petty meanness. Know what I mean?"
"I grew up around here, remember?" she said. "No matter where I go, it's going to follow me. But I was never indicted for any crime. And believe me, they looked hard and long.
I just want you to be ready, in case people are nasty to me or snigger when I walk by.
That's why I came here rather than trying to find some new place where I could be a stranger with a new identity. Everyone figures it out eventually. Lies don't last. Richard was proof of that. Let's just get it over with.
I was married to the late Richard Compton, the infamous broker and thief. There's no way to undo it, and I didn't have to think about it long. The stress of trying to keep it secret is something I'm just not up to. I could change my name, color my hair, even get a nose job if I had any money. But eventually everyone is going to know it's me.
It's hopeless, Lyle. Google me and see for yourself.
Under Emma Shea?
and Emma Shea Compton, Emma Compton, Emma Catherine Shea.
Dear God,
he groaned.
I hope it dwindles away quickly, he said.
It's all on the record. Anyone who's curious is welcome to read all about it. There are even a couple of books, though they're not very accurate.
How'd he do it, Em?
She knew exactly what he was talking about. Richard's suicide. She took a breath. She was surprised he hadn't just looked it up. It was splattered, like Richard's brains, across all the papers and internet news sites. After he'd attempted to run via a colleague's private jet with a fake passport, he was returned to jail and held without bond. The lawyers managed to negotiate house arrest with an ankle bracelet. After the guilty verdict was returned, he tried to negotiate sentencing by giving up offshore account numbers, hoping to reduce his sentence. But no matter what, he was going to jail for a long time. He opened the hidden safe behind the bookcase in his home office, pulled out his loaded Glock, and shot himself in the head. Lyle shook his head.
He didn't want to go to prison.
I'm sure it was more than that, she said.
Oh, there was no doubt prison would be horrendous, but that's not why he did it.
There was no material wealth left. There were no more offshore or Swiss accounts. It was really over. He was going to go to prison for 50 years, and even if he was paroled early or could escape, there was nothing to allow him to retire quietly in Aruba or some other remote island. With his stash. She sighed. It was the most important thing to him. The wealth.
I'm surprised the police didn't know about the safe or the gun, he said.
Didn't you say they searched the apartment? She shrugged. I don't know if they ever saw it. They weren't looking for it. They confiscated his computers and lots of files from home and his office, all his electronics. But their warrant wasn't for things like guns or drugs. I didn't know about the gun.
Did he do anything at all to try to protect you?
Lyle asked. She just shook her head.
And after he was buried?
It was a couple of weeks yet until everything was gone and the paperwork on the auction and the sale of the apartment was final. I closed his office door and slept on a cot in the kitchen. It was the safest place for me. Marshals were watching the apartment and there was a doorman. She made a face. It was so horrible.
I'm only going to say this one more time, Emmy. Then we're moving on. I'm just so, so sorry.
Thank you, she said softly. Listen, you go home and tell Ethan that I appreciate how decent he's been and assure him I'm not going to be pestering the two of you. I found I do very well on my own. It's lovely to be near you, but you don't have to worry that this out-of-place girlfriend is going to be the needy type and make you feel invaded. I'm not going to be your third wheel. We have some very nice friends, a lot of them gay men, and there are more than enough third wheels in our crowd. Don't worry about it. Call us whenever you feel like it.
You've been wonderful. You've always been a better friend to me than I've been to you, she said.
Not true. There have been very kind gestures here and there.
Shh, she warned.
Before the trouble began, she had a household budget that was ridiculously large, and she economized, leaving her a nice balance. It was her money, and she used some to help fund the startup of Hello Gorgeous. Best if no one ever knew. Lyle had been interviewed about their relationship, possibly even investigated, but had never been any kind of suspect. In fact, they didn't speak of it. Emma was fairly sure Ethan didn't even know the details.
Suffice it to say, I'm glad you're here, Lyle said. I've missed you. And now there are a couple of things I should tell you. People have asked about you, which of course they would, but a couple of old friends have asked a few times recently. Asked what you would do now. Riley came into the shop and asked if you were all right. She knows we've always been in touch, just as you know I keep up with her, but where you two are concerned, I made it a policy to never carry tales between you. She wanted to know if there was anything you needed.
Guilty conscience, Emma said.
Easy, Emma. She might be one of the few people who can actually understand what you're going through,
he said.
I know you're not sympathetic, but she had to rebuild her life after you left. And Jock called. Divorced and living in Santa Rosa. He wanted to know if there was any chance you'd be coming back this way when it was all over. He said to tell you that if you need anything...
Seriously? She asked.
Very sincerely. I'm not his biggest fan, but he did offer support.
She said nothing.
Of course, she knew they were both here, Riley and Jock. Back when they were all so young, her best friend and her boyfriend. She'd returned for brief visits a few times after leaving so long ago and hadn't spoken to them. But she always knew they were still around. When she decided to come back here for good, she knew it was possible she'd run into one or both of them eventually.
Might be time to move on from that haunt, Emma, Lyle said.
I have moved on, she answered. I've moved on from a lot of things, and I'm not going back one step.
Chapter 2. When Emma Catherine Shea was 9 years old, a fourth grader at St. Pascal's Elementary School in Santa Rosa, a couple of new kids came to school. Riley and Adam Kerrigan. Riley was in Emma's class, and the teacher asked her to be responsible for helping Riley get acquainted and adjusted. Emma, known for being friendly and a child who wished to please, was annoyed. First of all, she already had two best friends, Susanna and Paula, and Riley's hanging around was interfering with her routine. Second, Riley apparently couldn't talk. She followed along or sat at the lunch table all quiet and nervous. When she did speak, she could barely be heard. Third, and Emma knew this was wrong, but the girl was a rag doll. She wore old clothes that didn't even fit her right. Riley's older brother, Adam, so somber and quiet, waited after school to walk home together, so at least Emma didn't have that chore. And all of it, spending time with Riley, was monotonous. But, so Sister Judith would be proud of her, Emma did the best she could with the odd little creature with the unhappy personality. At the end of the second day, Riley surprised Emma when she spoke softly.
I know where to go and what to do now. You can go be with your friends.
Emma felt like a turd.
We'll just all hang out together, she said,
hating her overzealous conscience.
Then, over the next few days, Emma learned that Riley, Adam, and their mother came to Santa Rosa to live with Riley's grandparents in their tiny house because Riley's dad had gotten very sick and died. So now Riley wasn't just shy and poor, she was also bereaved. Emma was stuck with her. But Emma couldn't deny that she was completely sympathetic. She'd lost her own mother, though she had been too young to remember her. Her father had remarried when she was just a toddler, probably largely to have help with his child. He had married Rosemary, an efficient and hard-working widow with a 3-year-old daughter, Anna. 3 years later, they had a baby together, another girl, baby Lauren. The only mother she'd ever known was her stepmother, and of the three children, Rosemary liked Emma least. Emma understood by the time she was 10 that it had been a marriage of convenience. Emma was plotting her escape from Riley when a few things shifted as Riley got more comfortable with her new surroundings. First off, she was hilarious, and once they got laughing, they could hardly stop. When she wasn't feeling scared and lonely, Riley's voice was strong and confident. She was very good in school and rose to the head of the class quickly. She could help Emma, and not the other way around.
And Riley's mother, June, turned out to be the most wonderful, loving, fun, and positive woman in the entire world, embracing Emma and making her feel so cherished. Riley's grandparents acted like it was their lucky day the Kerrigans moved in, even though they were stuffed into the little house. They were crowded and money was tight, but there was more laughter there than there had ever been in Emma's house. Riley and Adam wore hand-me-down clothes. Their grandparents were elderly, and June Kerrigan cleaned houses and waitressed to make ends meet. But Emma was always welcome, made to feel like a member of the family. Emma's home life wasn't nearly so happy. Rosemary wasn't abusive in any obvious way, but she was emotionally flat where Emma was concerned. Rosemary complained about how hard she had to work at the DMV, how much stress she had in her life, how messy and lazy Emma's father was, her weight, her friends, and a variety of issues. Aside from Anna and Lauren, there didn't seem to be much she enjoyed. Although Rosemary always referred to Emma and Lauren as her daughters, there was little doubt that Anna was her favorite. It wasn't long before Emma was happier at Riley's house than at her own. And hardly surprisingly, Rosemary didn't mind her absence at home much. "We're going to be each other's maid of honor. We were going to have children at the same time so they could be best friends too." From the day Sister Judith forced them together until high school graduation, Emma and Riley were inseparable. Riley's grandpa called them conjoined twins. They stuck together through thick and thin, through the sudden death of Emma's father when she was 16, Rosemary's third marriage to Vince Kingston, and every issue that plagued teenagedom. Their friendship was cast in iron, and they had very few tiffs. Until they fell out over a boy. One Jock Curry. Yes, it was his given name. He was named for a grandfather. They'd both crushed on him in high school. They thought he was smart, sexy, athletic, funny. Every girl wanted him, and he apparently wanted every girl. But once he settled on Emma during their senior year, that was it for him. He said his roaming days were over. Of course, he was all of 17 at the time. He tried to talk Emma into going to the same community college he'd chosen, or at least staying close to home. But she had a scholarship and was going to Seattle Pacific University, known for its interior design program. Of the two girls, she was the least likely to get a scholarship. But even with one, Riley's family couldn't afford any part of the expense of living away from home or attending an out-of-state university. Emma could manage with working part-time, taking out loans, and Rosemary was able to send a little money. 50 here, 50 there. And she had big dreams. She was going to design the interiors of 5-star hotels and luxurious mansions. Riley enrolled in the same community college as Jock, lived at home, and began cleaning houses just like her mom always had. Jock had no specific plans except to get the minimum education, work part-time, play a little baseball, and enjoy himself. Emma didn't suspect anything was going on in her absence until right before Christmas break. Riley was acting strangely. Jock and Riley were hanging out together a lot. But shouldn't that be expected? Her guy and her best friend, going to school together and everything. She trusted them after all. Then she had this nagging feeling it wasn't all right. That it was a betrayal. Riley was different toward her. Jock was a little too much himself. Jovial and confident and relaxed. He'd gone from ragging on her about taking more time to talk to him on the phone to not noticing how long it had been since they'd had one of those long, whispery late-night conversations. She suspected her best friend was too close to her boyfriend. When Emma confronted her, Riley burst into tears, admitted it, swore it wasn't entirely her fault, that Jock had taken advantage of the fact that she'd always liked him a lot, that she'd been so lonely without her best friend. Jock had said,
Hey, grow up. It didn't really mean anything. Besides, what did you expect? You didn't have time for either one of us.
Emma never really did understand how something like that just happens, especially when both Riley and Jacques insisted they hadn't meant it to, that it was all a terrible mistake. Then they both turned it back on her, as if it was her fault for going away to school. All she knew was that she was devastated and had lost the two most important people in her life. She could never trust either one of them again, and the feeling was so painful it doubled her over. She went back to Seattle after Christmas break, completely decimated by the hurt. She tried to date, and that didn't go well. Riley wrote her a couple of letters, left her a few messages, but Emma was too hurt to respond. And she didn't go back to Santa Rosa until summer break. Even then, she hadn't wanted to. There was nothing there for her anymore. Her father was dead. Her stepmother was a cold fish who clearly hated her. Her stepmother's new husband was an old lecher. Her sisters didn't care about her. She didn't stay in Santa Rosa long. She learned what no one wanted to tell her. Oh, but Emma's stepsister Anna couldn't wait to tell her. Riley was pregnant. While Emma was at school, those two had been knocking boots like mad, and now they were having a baby. Emma bid a tearful goodbye to Lyle, cleared everything out of her father's house, the house she grew up in, and headed back to Seattle as fast as she could. She got herself a job, joined a sorority, visited Santa Rosa very rarely and very briefly. When she did go, she stayed with Lyle. Even Seattle wasn't far enough away. Upon her graduation, she secured a job in New York and moved to the other coast. Within 3 years, she was a buyer for one of the largest independent department stores in the U.S. and traveled all over the world for her household wares. She was a specialist in interiors and had fantasies about starting her own design firm. But then she met Richard. If there was one thing Emma had learned from the experience, it was that she could hold a grudge. The fact that Riley's relationship with Jacques hadn't lasted, proving that he wasn't exactly a good catch, didn't lessen her feelings of being betrayed. The undeniable truth that she'd dodged a bullet when her relationship with Jacques fell apart didn't give her much comfort. The further fact that she'd gone on to marry a handsome, rich, successful man also hadn't induced her to forgive and forget. But then what she went through with Richard, his fraud, deceit, demise, taught her something else. There were bigger things to worry about than a 15-year-old feud with a childhood friend. There was no going back, Emma reminded herself. She was moving forward. Emma hadn't worked outside her home and marriage for 9 years, but boy, had she worked in it. She visited several employment agencies with her resume, her degree, even details of her experience volunteering at the Metropolitan Museum of Art, working on gigantic fundraisers, massive decorating projects, and entertaining on an enormous scale. But that simply wouldn't do it after the interview. She felt it was in her best interest to be honest, then immediately doubted her wisdom in that. If they didn't want to take her on as a client because they feared trusting her, then they didn't want her because of the potential negative press attention it might draw to them. Clients might leave businesses that employed her because of her notoriety. Of course, they didn't say that. They said they were sorry, there didn't seem to be anything available, but if she'd leave a number, she had to throw her net wider. She had a list of businesses to apply to that ranged from galleries and stores to convention centers, wineries, and even political parties. She stopped explaining that her late husband had been the Richard Compton and instead said that, after a bad marriage, she was re-entering the workforce. After 2 weeks with zero success, she went to several smaller employment agencies, not the ones that specialized in decorating, customer service, event planning, and those things that were ideal for her. After all, she could always type and file. She could operate a computer. She thought the reception she received was positive, until they looked into her background, which was a simple matter nowadays with a computer search. Even though she wasn't upfront about her history, they obviously Googled her, and she was politely informed there was nothing available that might suit her. After 4 weeks, she was inconsolable. "Isn't this some kind of discrimination?" she asked Lyle.
"It definitely is,"
Lyle said.
"But I'm not sure what kind." Just when she thought things couldn't possibly get bleaker, she took a job in a fast food restaurant. She thought of it as a placeholder until she found a real job. Her boss was 19 years old. She did everything she was told to do, putting great effort into it. They'd given her an evening shift because she was mature and the restaurant was overrun with high school and college kids. But she had trouble keeping up. She took home a paycheck for 5 days of shift work at about 5 hours a day in the amount of $91.75. They deducted FICA, Social Security, state and federal taxes, uniform costs. Her net pay was $3.67 per hour. Her feet and back were killing her. She wondered if she'd have to succumb to a disguise and create a new identity. Emma answered her cell phone, knowing it would be Lyle, but praying it would be someone with an offer of a better job. It was Lyle. "Do you know a man by the name of Aaron Justice?" She laughed. "Unforgettable. A friend of my father's. An attorney. He must be 100 years old by now. More like 75. Apparently one of your sisters said you could be reached through me, and he'd love to hear from you. He said maybe you could meet for a coffee or something. He's been concerned about you. He would like to see you, to assure himself you're okay."
"Now isn't that sweet?" she said.
"It's not a trap, is it? He's not representing someone Richard screwed, is he?" "Does that actually happen?" Lyle asked. "It hasn't happened yet, but I'm ready for it." "I have his number," Lyle said. "Call him, ask him what he wants before you make a date to see him. But really, he's just a little old man."
"Oh, you have no idea," she said with a laugh.
"Aaron is only a little old man on the outside. I think in his day he was a very prominent attorney."
It took her a few minutes to work up her courage, because it would simply break her heart if Aaron Justice were foe, not friend. Her father, a CPA with a small but busy business, was close to Aaron, and Emma had known him all her life. Not only had they seen him and his family socially, Aaron was the lawyer who took care of John Shay's will and a few other legal matters, too.
"I want only to see you, my dear girl," Aaron said. "I followed your ordeal in the news and have been concerned. Come and have a cup of coffee with me."
The very next afternoon that she didn't have to work, they met in a coffee shop in Santa Rosa, and when she saw him, it brought her to tears. He seemed to have gotten smaller, but his embrace was still strong, and she might have held on too tight. He was a very dapper, classy gentleman, and of course, just seeing him again after 18 years made her miss her father. They sat in a small booth, ordered coffee, and held hands across the table as they caught up on the more personal news. His wife had passed away a few years earlier. His grandsons were teenagers, and he'd taken them on a few exciting trips. He was relieved to see her looking so well, as beautiful as ever, and he was glad she was back. Finally, after about 20 minutes, he asked her if she could talk about it. She tried to give him the bullet points, how shocked she was by the facts, stunned to learn she was married to a stranger, how the walls came tumbling down and Richard bailed out. "Once they were satisfied that I had nothing to do with the scheme, I was offered a settlement. My conscience wouldn't let me take it, of course."
"Your father would have been proud of that," Aaron said.
"If my father had witnessed that horrific takedown, he would have been mortified."
"He was a staunch and conservative man,"
Aaron said.
It sounds as if he would have approved of the way you chose to handle it. I hope your father's trust helped out a bit.
She laughed. What trust, Aaron? Rosemary said there wasn't much.
I seem to remember it being a tidy sum for his family.
18 years ago, maybe, Emma said. He frowned.
I realize you were only a girl, and John hadn't wanted the balances to be reported to anyone. It might have filled the three of you girls with fanciful notions, sent you out car shopping or something. But it was divided. Your share and those of your sisters could only be used for health and welfare. Rosemary would have needed it to sustain the family, and there was tuition to pay, of course.
Emma was shaking her head. I borrowed and had a partial scholarship. She might have used it for education for Lauren and Anna.
Didn't Rosemary give you money for college?
She sent me spending money from time to time. Maybe she was afraid to touch the money, saving it for her old age. She ended up marrying a real jerk. They moved to Palm Springs.
Rosemary changed lawyers immediately,
Aaron said.
I have no idea what's happened in the last 18 years, but you were due to inherit from your father's estate, half at the age of 30 and half at 35. It was important to John that you learn to make your own way and earn a living before you came into any money, or you'd have blown it on shoes or something.
She smiled. That sounds like him, she said. He was so cautious.
It was an irrevocable trust, Emma. As trustee, Rosemary could only use your portion on your needs, not on Anna's or Lauren's. Have you ever had an accounting done?
Aaron asked. Of what?
Of your father's estate. The terms of his will.
Aaron, I was married to one of the richest men in New York. Why would I worry about my father's will? He had a small office in a small town and lectured me if I threw a pen out before it was writing in invisible ink. I wouldn't call him a tightwad, but he didn't let go of a dime before he'd squeezed all the juice out of it. Aaron laughed.
It's true. And he married a woman who liked nice things.
Well, she didn't waste any money on me. After my first year of college, I admitted defeat with Rosemary and hardly ever came home to visit. And you know what happened when I struck out on my own. I fell in love with and married a thief.
May I make a suggestion? You should ask for an accounting of your father's estate. There's still the house. It's a substantial house.
She said the mortgage alone was killing her, Emma pointed out.
Emma, the house was insured against your father's death. There was no mortgage. I still have a small practice, mostly just for old clients and friends. If I were your attorney, I could look into this.
She started to laugh. Oh, Aaron, you are so sweet. I can't afford an attorney. I'm working at a fast food restaurant. Besides, if there turned out to be something left of his estate after all these years, would I have to fight for it? Because I can't even consider going to court. Not ever again.
Here's what would happen. I would see her lawyer or accountant, petition for an accounting of the proceeds of the estate on your behalf, and if there turned out to be something left for you, you'd have to sue. It usually doesn't go that far unless there are millions at stake. If it's a small amount, the trustee is usually happy to settle to save money. And if there is anything, I won't charge a fee of any kind until you can afford it. It wouldn't be a contingency or percentage, just my usual fee, which, he said, laughing at himself, is a steal.
Well, I won't be suing anyone, that's for sure. I won't even ask for anything from her. She hates me, and at this point the feeling is mutual. I'm starting over. But you are kind, and I appreciate your generosity.
Let's find out, Emma. There was once some money involved, and your father's house. That was a rich house, wasn't it? Everyone envied it.
He built it with my mother, she said. He never said, but I think they hoped to have a few children. She shook her head. Even the idea of money makes me sick. I live in two rooms. I pinch my pennies in a way that would make John Shay so proud. And I can't bear the idea of owing you money for services that you're really doing as a favor.
If it turns out there's nothing there, or if you choose not to pursue the recovery of it, my fee will be zero.
Her eyes got a little round. Why, Aaron, I think you wouldn't mind catching Rosemary with her hand in the cookie jar.
You found me out,
he said.
John was such a gentle man. She seemed to suck the life out of him.
I think he married Rosemary to have help with me, she said. It must have been so hard for him. And everyone who knew my mother loved her. I don't think people even like Rosemary. She's a hard woman. He was quiet for a moment.
John was a good friend. He was careful with his will. It would take months to get an answer, Emma. Months before you have to decide how to proceed. For your peace of mind, I'd be happy to look into this for you. She shrugged.
Why not? What can it hurt? I won't get my hopes up. If Rosemary was involved, I'm sure she's had a real party spending it. She quit working the week my dad died.
And I have something important to do, and it makes me so happy to do it for you.
He squeezed her hand.
I'm glad you came home, Emma.
Lyle was finishing up for the day, standing at the counter while he looked at the orders for Saturday delivery. In August, sales started picking up again after summer. In summer, there weren't any floral holidays, and people had their own blooms. Summer in Sonoma County was pure heaven. The door to the shop opened, and he smiled to see Riley Kerrigan come in. Took her long enough, he thought. He hadn't seen her in at least a couple of months. She looked fantastic as usual. You'd never guess by looking at her that she owned a domestic and industrial cleaning service. She looked more like a bank executive or high-powered attorney. After all her years of secondhand clothes, followed by scrimping to get by and build her business, Riley was making up for lost time in the wardrobe category.
Hi, she said.
I thought I might catch you before you left for the day. How's it going?
It's all good. How's everything at Happy Housekeeping?
He asked, knowing full well that was not the name of her business.
Happy, happy, happy.
So, is she back?
He nodded. Over a month now, he said.
Tell me something. Did it take willpower to wait this long to ask?
I didn't expect her to call, if that's what you're getting at. How is she? Riley asked.
Doing very well, in spite of everything.
Riley's smile was very small. Emma has a way of bouncing back.
If she can bounce back from this, she's a superhero.
She stayed in that apartment alone, slept on a cot, even though her husband's blood was all over his study, because no one offered her a guest room, not even the legal team who were so well paid. And she wasn't safe in a hotel. Too many victims of Richard's fraud threatened her. I offered to go out there, but she wouldn't have it. She didn't want me in jeopardy. She made the drive to California by herself. She said she needed the time alone and away. Her husband has been dead a few months. It took her a month here to find a bad job. She says she's holding up very well. I'm amazed she's even standing.
I'm sorry she's going through this, but she wouldn't want my sympathy or my help. If you think of anything I can do without, you know, getting involved, let me know.
Sure, he said. She says she's over it, by the way. Your feud.
Me too, Riley said. But still,
she said that too.
Riley smiled at her dear friend. They'd been the Three Musketeers in high school. Emma, Lyle, and Riley. She gave a quiet laugh and shook her head.
Can I buy the man in the middle a drink? She asked.
By all means, Lyle said.
I think she's forgiven you by now.
Good to know. I still hate her, but I'm not mad at her anymore.
Oh, great. He started turning off lights. Let's go drink.
Riley stopped by the grocery after a glass of wine with Lyle. They'd been friends for a long time. Usually threesomes don't work very well, but in this case, Lyle being a guy and all, there was no issue. At least not until Emma and Riley had their epic breakup. Then Lyle was stuck in the middle, trying not to take sides. He'd managed to remain loyal to both women for 16 years. She was lost in thought, her hand absently palming a honeydew melon.
"I'm not sure if you're going to bowl with that or put it in your cart," a male voice said.
She looked up and smiled. She'd seen this guy before. Starbucks, maybe. "Sorry," she said, taking the melon, though she didn't really want it.
"They look good today, don't they?"
he asked.
"Hey, do you know where I can find roasted peppers? Fire roasted?" he said, consulting a list.
She shook herself for a second, coming back to grocery land and leaving thoughts of poor Lyle and their triangle far behind.
Over there with the olives are some prepared in the jar. That's all I know about."
"Artichoke hearts?"
"Same place, in the jar, or some in the frozen section."
"Parmesan?"
She smiled at him. He was very good looking.
"You're making artichoke dip, aren't you? Let me see that," she said.
She glanced over the recipe.
"There aren't any roasted peppers in this recipe."
"I know. It's for something else. I'm just picking them up for a neighbor."
"Thank goodness."
"Okay, be sure the artichokes are packed in water. Add a half cup of mozzarella, a sprinkle of chili powder, and a cup of chopped spinach, and some lucky woman